He's looking for a little taste of the sublime that he reads about in these old Arctic exploration books, and goes looking for it and finds probably not even close to what he was looking for.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Nathaniel Ian Miller, author of The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, the story of Sven Ormsson, a restless industrial worker who, in 1916, seeks adventure in a mining camp between mainland Norway and the North Pole. Though it lingers often on the chill and isolation of the Arctic, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven is an endearingly warm story, ultimately of chosen family and of familial love. Nathaniel, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Will you begin by reading an excerpt from your novel, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven?
Okay, so this is my book, The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, and I'm going to begin reading to you from the prologue. I'm going to try not to make page noises. Prologue, from a tiny cabin by the ocean. My name is Sven. To some, I am known as Stockholm Sven, and to others, Sven One Eye, or Sven the Seal. I arrived in Spitsbergen in 1916. I was 32 years old and hadn't amounted to much. I have some sense of what is said about me by the few who might say anything at all, that I lived and trapped alone in the great bay and hunting grounds of Rødfjorden in the farthest north, that I was the pitiable victim of a mining accident, that I had irrepressible eccentricities and abjured society. This is all true, in a way, and yet less than true. And let it be struck from the record that I was a talented and enthusiastic cook, as some have claimed, for that is a flagrant falsehood. I expended the greater part of my life in Spitsbergen, an island archipelago due north of Norway, whose uppermost reaches are but a handful of degrees from the invisible pole. These days the place is called Svalbard, by politicians, generals, and cartographers, or by all but the most precious few, it is called nothing. For the age of exploration is long over, and if Spitsbergen still dwells in the popular imagination, it exists only as a faint echo, a half-remembered word. People might wonder, I suppose, or do I only fancy that they wonder, how I kept myself busy those many solitary decades. Perhaps they think a life is made up of milestones, great monoliths rising above an endless roving sea that both washes and abrades them. I think that is rubbish. Few memoirs are written, and fewer still are read. So in most cases we must rely upon only two or three markers, often dubious, when peering through the grimy glass into someone else's existence. A life is substantially more curious and mundane than the reports would have it. And in truth, though I am known within the tiny dewdrop circles of the unlikely few who know of me as a solitary, unmatched Arctic hunter, I am no such thing, and I was seldom alone. This is my story.
For listeners who have yet to encounter The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven, can you tell us a little bit about this character, about Sven Ormsson?
Sure. Loosely based is probably about as generous a term as you can use, but it is loosely based on a real guy about whom we know very little. I've since learned a little more since I wrote the thing, but and in any case, we know almost nothing about the real guy. He went to Spitsbergen the same year that Sven did in the 19-teens, and there was horrifically injured in a mining accident, an avalanche, and his face was mutilated, and after that point became somewhat reclusive and removed himself to this extremely isolated fjord in the northern part of the archipelago, and for the most part lived out his days there. And that's really where my novel takes everything. You know, that's where it begins, and that's where the nonfiction part ends. I'd say it's about 99% fiction. My character, whose name is, his last surname is changed, is a bit of a moody, melancholic, self-alienating character. I wouldn't really call him a misanthrope, but he does struggle in Stockholm society and in his mill jobs, and he's looking for a little taste of the sublime that he reads about in these old Arctic exploration books, and goes looking for it and finds probably not even close to what he was looking for.
And Sven's voice in the book, the narrative voice, really, because this is his memoir, right? He's a book taught intellectual in the early 20th century. So much of the dialogue is formal, too. And the voice, this formal voice, serves the tone of the book so well. And I got the impression that Sven, he's careful and measured in his thinking. I'm wondering, craft-wise, where did that voice come from? How did you learn to write in that voice?
Well, to be honest with you, much of it came out of thin air, but I've read these same terribly tedious narratives that Sven did. And so I've absorbed some of that kind of stentorian, droning voice, a tendency to be a little bit grandiloquent at times, but also I love that language. And much of the sort of fun with formality that I had comes through osmosis from reading and rereading and rereading the Patrick O'Brien novels. It takes place in an earlier period, Napoleonic Wars, but such glorious language, and not just the formal language, but the way sailors might speak to each other. And so that certainly was an influence.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the voice, and while I was reading, I was wondering what your natural fiction voice is. You know, like, are you always taking on the voice of the characters you're writing about? Are you a formal writer in that way?
I couldn't answer that question. I don't think of myself as a formal writer per se. Certainly, some of that voice is just my voice, for sure. And I like that kind of language, and I enjoy using it, hopefully not overusing it. But in other things I've written, I would say in another era, in another setting, the tone would be much, much more natural.
So even though, you know, Sven is isolated, and this book is so much about isolation, there are so many other characters apart from Sven in this book, and there's a through line or many through lines throughout the novel, whether they be thought or said aloud, about the relationships between the different countries that you're writing about, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Russia, England. What kind of historical research did you dive into to get the nuances of these Scandinavian relationships right?
Okay, now I really have to admit that I derived much enjoyment from playing the Scandinavian countries off of each other and throwing Russia in there and England. And much of that I just made up. And I had this I had this sort of idea of how maybe they might ridicule one another or disparage one another based on almost nothing. Certainly, I know the history, their disagreements, their border issues, the fact that sometimes, you know, Sweden would be neutral in a war, and this, I could sort of pull it from history, but yeah, much of it was made up. I have this fantasy that at one point the book will be translated into the Scandinavian languages and read by people who will laugh ruefully and shake their heads about how wrong I got it. I did speak to a Danish woman early in the process of trying to get it published. She worked in the industry, who said, "How did you know how the different Scandinavian cultures talk about each other. And I had to admit that I didn't, and I just made it up.
I mean, how lucky. Her comment seems to presume that you got it right, right?
It sounded like it. I'm going with that.
Yeah. Where did your interest in Scandinavia come from? Do you have Scandinavian heritage?
I have zero Scandinavian heritage. What the interest that led me into this book is strictly in Arctic and Antarctic exploration. That was the gateway for me to these regions, their history. So, and this all began with my mother. She introduced me to Alfred Lansing's Endurance when I was far too young to understand it, but that was the beginning. And from there, reading Amundsen, reading Nansen, reading about Salomon André and his ice balloon, which was a catastrophic disaster, that led me to the history of Scandinavian Arctic exploration. I loved how everything they did seemed to be in opposition to how the British had been doing it for a century or so. And in their innovations, their whole approach was like, I see how you're doing it over there in England. It's all wrong. We're going to do it a different way, a better way. And often they were right. So it led to some interesting times.
It sounds like your obsession with the Arctic and exploration in the Arctic started when you were little. How has that relationship changed, especially since writing this book?
Well, there are a number of things that I share that I have in common with the character of Sven and some of the other characters in the book. One of them is that I, like Sven, had a desire to seek adventure in isolated places, particularly the cold places. And though I sought adventure elsewhere, I never was able to get up to the Arctic until I found this artist residency. But by that time, though I have this deep and abiding interest in the polar regions, my desire to sublimate myself and test the limits of my human endurance has certainly dimmed or been, I'd just as soon not turn my body into a ghost of itself in some absurd effort.
Nathaniel, what does it mean to think like a walrus?
One of my first notions for this book came from stepping in the actual hut, the real Stockholm Sven, which I got to visit. And I began to contemplate, or instantly began to contemplate, questions that have always interested me, but in this case, it sort of takes it to a new extreme. How can a person live in isolation that severe, that thorough, for the length of time that he did? And what does that do to the mind? How do you cope? I've thought about these questions a lot in terms of fire lookout towers and fallout shelters and people who just live alone, even in a city. You know, how do you change your mind to survive? And so I started to think of slowing it down. I talk about in the book thinking, becoming like a stone, experiencing time geologically, the inner monologues, then the bits of chatter all sort of fade out into nothing, into the void. And what you're left with is just sort of slow, measured experience. And I think of that as also similar to maybe the experience of a walrus or any creature living out there. You've got your life cycle, you've got your seasons. It's sort of a simple life, and therefore one you can survive.
So I'm hoping you're gonna come with me in this leap here that I'm about to make. But is that idea, this thinking like a walrus, perhaps, is that how you see your life in Vermont? And maybe even beyond that, is that how you see your life in Vermont as a cattle farmer being like the Arctic?
Not a leap at all. Absolutely. I'd say I'm not there yet, and I probably never will be, but that's always been my goal. Ever since I moved out west when I was right out of college, I'd been working at West during college, and I started to do these ranch jobs and various things, as well as alternating with a journalism career. I got a taste for that silence that can become internal. As someone who has always been plagued by too much internal chatter and monologues and everything else, it's such a rare joy for things to become quiet inside. And I've been chasing that dragon ever since. And so I just sort of projected that notion onto the Arctic as a place where this might be possible. And on a personal note, yes, absolutely. Aside from the fact that I'm not very good at working for other people and a variety of other considerations that led me to the farming ranching life, certainly I'm healthiest when there's a great deal of silence, both external and internal, and cattle ranching, other than the loud bellowing that the cows make at various times of the day or year, it lends itself to a slower existence for sure. And that was the plan for years, was to get to this point. And I continue searching for that kind of life.
It certainly lends itself to the writing life too, huh?
Absolutely. I need serious silence, and I don't have to go anywhere. I'm in my office right now. I'm looking out over the barnyard. I can actually see the cows from here. It's pretty peaceful.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Nathaniel Ian Miller, author of The Memoirs of Stockholm Sven. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There's a passage about halfway through the novel in which Sven's mentor, and I might need pronunciation here, a trapper named Tapio?
Yeah, Tapio, I think. You got it.
He tells him that he's going to leave the hunting grounds they had been occupying together. And Sven is, as you write in the book, crestfallen. You write, "Despair can only be diminished or ignored. After all, not exercised. It lives within you like a worm." Nathaniel, how does despair live within you, and how do you go about diminishing it?
I'd say I believe that's a true statement, not an exaggeration that Sven makes. It could have just come from my mouth. I do believe despair doesn't really ever go away and has to be sort of muted or repressed or whatever is necessary. For me, the things that keep it at bay are plenty of exercise, as much light as I can get, which, as you know, in these northern regions is hard to find this time of year. Walks in the woods, time with my family, reading, my dog, the usual things, I think, that can stave off despair. Eating, drinking, perhaps eating and drinking double that in the winter months.
You mentioned your dog, and so perhaps this question has already been answered, but Nathaniel, are you a dog person?
Oh, absolutely. I am a dog person.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that dogs play in the novel?
Sure, I'd love to. So I have never really written dogs before, and I saw this as an opportunity both to rectify or attempt to rectify something that irks me in the things that I read, which is dogs being used as plot devices, where they appear to further the protagonist's movement throughout the story, and then they're sort of gone, or their death is used as sort of a flippant way to push the narrative along or cause some emotional response. I think of it, you know the term fridging? It refers to female characters being killed off in a way that just it doesn't give any respect to their character or any depth. It's just like, here's a female character now dead in order to advance the male protagonist's movement through the story. And so I think of this as like dog fridging. That's a common practice. So anyway, without getting too long-winded, I wanted to write dogs, and it's been done before, of course, beautifully in several books I love. But I wanted to give dogs a character that is more enduring, essential to the story, but not in just a contrived way. And then also selfishly, to basically give my dogs a kind of immortality. So both the major dogs in the book, Eberhard and 610, are based on dogs of mine. Eberhard is based on my old dog Lalo, who was with me in Missoula, and actually, if I'm being honest, was one of the reasons why I had to leave that house. He died the same year I left Missoula, and I found I could barely exist in that house anymore or walk the same trails up Paddy Canyon that I had walked every day for 6 years. And so he, in so many ways, is Eberhard. And all the idiosyncrasies, doesn't really look like him, but certainly acted like him. And then Sixten, the second dog that Sven has, is based on my current dog, Bonaparte, who's snoring right next to me. I don't know if you could hear it in the audio, but he's now 9. We bought him, or we didn't buy him. We got him from my wife's sibling's farm in Wisconsin right when we moved to Vermont, and he's a cattle dog.
I love knowing that those dogs are based on real dogs. They are characters in the book just as much as the human characters or the landscape or the other animals in the book, too. They all have, I'll call it, equal representation, I guess. And that's something that I kind of want to talk about or have you touch on, is this representation in the book, because there are a number of women in the book. Even though Sven is obviously a man and there are other men kind of dotting the book too, there are also a number of women. There are a number of queer characters. There's Jewish characters. So can you tell me about how you wrote these characters who in life and in other literary, you know, representations, they don't have that representation?
The idea of representation is paramount for me. And I tried to put it into action as well as I could, given this setting and this period. But I would say that the fleshing out, the introducing and the fleshing out of strong female characters, queer characters, Jewish character, it's all a kind of wish fulfillment, in that I hope it doesn't come off as contrived to the readers. I want it to feel natural. But in the same way that, you know, people talk about some place like Alaska is sort of home to those who have trouble fitting in elsewhere, find society's constraints kind of binding. And I thought of Svalbard, my fictional Svalbard, as a place like that, where people, as I think they put it in the book, cast-offs from society might find a community of their own. And of course, we're talking about a very tiny community, in that these are just Sven's friends and family. But it was important for me that they be there, and that some marginalized groups be represented, and also that the representation not feel manipulative or exploitative in a way. That really, as in the case of the queer characters, and there are quite a few in this book, that it really be taken for granted. It's not the most important part of their character. It's just who they are. And I think from what I've heard from folks in the queer community and such, I mean, that's an important thing as a reader, is to encounter characters who are in one way or another like them, but where it's not sort of necessarily
a novelty.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, sort of thrown in your face in this sort of front and center way that's seeking to make a point or anything like that.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about the different characters, and you even said, you know, Sven's family and friends. And so there's this tension in the book between kind of the desolation, the isolation of the space. He lives in his mind very much, but he's also in this very desolate, cold place. But I'm wondering how you were able to write from that perspective, from this place of deep isolation, but also, and this again speaks to this tension in the book, this isolation is counter to its warmth. It exists between the characters. These relationships are so warm. They are so caring, so thoughtful. These characters are so thoughtful of one another. And I'm wondering how you wrote toward warmth while writing about such a cold place.
I'm so glad to hear you say that and phrase it that way. That's exactly what I was hoping for and going for. I set out to write this thing thinking that it would just be the isolation. And I had actually written a novel before this one that really was purely isolation and more of the logical end that you would arrive at in that instance, and that the mind just falls apart. You can't keep it going. You can't keep your mind active or healthy. And it's, as we know from solitary confinement, it's lethal. And as I started writing this book, I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to see what, how long can this person survive out there, and what's it going to take, and what's it going to do to him? And very early on, and right, like within the first two chapters, I felt Sven evolving on the page. And as I introduce his sister, Olga, and her children who are so important to him, I started realizing that that was not the kind of book, the isolation story was not the story I needed to tell here, and that this was really about sort of crawling your way out of that through healthy and interesting interpersonal relationships. I think of Sven as someone who, he's not a cipher, but he would tell you he's the least interesting person in the room. And his life is given meaning by the people around him and the dogs. So that became clear to me fairly early on. And I started to see how those interpersonal relationships could develop and could hopefully give warmth to his life. And then that would come through for readers.
There are so many really funny moments in your book. Was that a natural occurrence in your writing? Is that part of the warmth that you were trying to put in it?
Yes, I think it goes hand in hand with the warmth. I just finished writing this novel that was just sort of grinds you through the pain of what isolation might really be like. And so in writing, I know I keep using this phrase, but in writing in opposition to that, almost writing a sort of funhouse mirror image of that book, I needed there to be, even in trying circumstances, a kind of dry wit coming out of the mouths of these various characters and them sort of expressing their senses of humor in various ways. Yes, I think that was key to giving them life and warmth.
Nathaniel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Tom Barrage. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.